Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Bhante Sujato, and this afternoon I thought I would talk a little bit about this book that we've just finished called The Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Texts. And those of you who were here on Friday night would know that this is a book which we've just completed, which has been published through the Oxford Centre for Buddhist Studies. So if you're interested to get a copy, you can download it from the Oxford Centre for Buddhist Studies site, or I believe that there's probably a link on the BSWA site now, and the printed version will be available soon. I'll just give a... I wanted to talk about it again this afternoon because I thought when I discussed it on Friday night, it was more of a general discussion, and I talked more about the background to it and the idea of authenticity and the meaning of it, rather than looking specifically at the thing itself. And so what I thought I'd do this afternoon, because it's a sutta class, people who have a bit more knowledge and interest in the suttas than a general audience, so I thought you might be interested to look at a bit more of the nitty-gritty of some of the arguments and ways and different ways we approach things. So I'll just give a very brief introduction and background. So this is a book which Ajahn Brahmani and myself have been working on for the past year or so. And it was mainly in response to a very strong skeptical strand within modern Buddhist studies, which essentially dismisses the idea that there can be, or that we can know whether there are any authentic Buddhist texts. And so it points to things like, say, the lack of an early manuscript tradition, the lack of direct corroboration from contemporary sources, the lack of archaeological finds from the time of the Buddha, and it argues that the only direct evidence we have for the existence of the Buddhist texts is from much later, and some people will argue we can't know anything about the early Buddhist texts until 1,000 years after the Buddha. So according to this movement, you're basically just talking hot air if you're talking about anything that the Buddha said or what the early Buddhist community did or anything like that. You're just making stuff up, basically. And this movement has been very influential, especially in American Buddhist studies, and has essentially taken the study of early Buddhism off the curriculum in much of academic studies. I mean that quite literally. People just simply don't read the suttas and have no idea what's in them. And so, of course, there's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you tell people there's nothing worth reading in the suttas, then nobody reads them, and, of course, nobody can find out whether there's anything worth reading in them. So I'm not... When I say these kinds of things, you possibly can come kind of exaggerating the influence of this. I'm not. And I could tell you many kind of anecdotes. I'll just tell you one anecdote, which again was one of the reasons why I started writing this, was a friend of mine, Miri Albahiri. Some of you may know Miri. She comes to the Buddhist Society quite regularly, and she's a philosopher at the UWA here, and she studies in Buddhist philosophy and does books and essays and things based on her interpretations of the suttas. And I like to get together with Miri every now and again, and we have some different ideas, so we have a good argument every now and then about what the suttas mean. And that's part of what it means to be a Buddhist community, is you have these scriptures that you can get together and disagree over, because if everybody agreed about them all the time, it would be very boring. So and she told me an anecdote one time that she was at a philosopher's conference or something like that, talking to somebody, and one of the philosophers, when she mentioned that she works with the early Buddhist texts, says, you know, why do you even bother doing that? You know, we don't even know what was said by the Buddha, or there's no historical basis to it, so it's a bit of a waste of time, really, isn't it? Right? So this is happening at a professional level among philosophers. Now, of course, the philosopher who said that wasn't an expert, okay? He wasn't a student of early Buddhism. He was passing on second-hand information. So these things, of course, get kind of dumbed down as they get passed around, even within the professional academic circuit, and, of course, much more so when you come to the Buddhist world at large. So one of the I think there are many issues with this, and I don't want to go on about it too long, but one of the, I find what's in the suttas is so beautiful, so profound, so full of meaning and depth, that I think it's a terrible shame that we lose that. And I don't see the same kind of depth in any of the later forms of Buddhism. I see that later forms of Buddhism take different aspects of what we find in the suttas and develop them in different ways. But none of them, I think, have the full breadth and the full depth of the wisdom that we find from the Buddha himself. So we would like to get people interested in reading the suttas, and we'd like to get people motivated and to convince that there's something to these things. Now, of course, the question whether the texts are historically spoken by the Buddha, in a sense, is beside the point. The real question, of course, is, can it lead to the ending of suffering? And please don't misunderstand anything that we're saying to be questioning this or anything. I mean, we're not trying to say that, you know, understanding textual critical authenticity is more important than actually meditating and overcoming suffering. Of course not. Don't be stupid, right? We are merely saying that if we are going to try and reach the ending of suffering, the Buddha should be our greatest guide. So let us use what wisdom we have, what reason we have, what evidence we have, to be able to discern what it is that the Buddha taught and what he didn't taught, so that that can help us in our path towards overcoming suffering. And so this is like a collection. We conceived of this as a collection of bits of data and bits of arguments. And one of the problems that we saw was that although there were very many arguments for the authenticity of the Buddha's texts, that these arguments had not been stated, and particularly that they had not been stated altogether, that bits and pieces of them have been stated, a lot of them in obscure journals, academic articles, old books and things like that, often dating back to the 19th century. And these things become a kind of assumed body of knowledge within the field of study. So if you're doing Pali studies or Indological studies and so on, it's assumed that you've read these articles and you know what they are. But of course, somebody who hasn't read them, doesn't know what the arguments are, hasn't looked at the evidence, wouldn't know where to start. And so people will kind of assume that there's nothing there. Another good example of that would be the recent kerfuffle a few months ago, towards the end of last year. There was a sort of a news flurry in the media. I don't know if you saw it, but everyone was saying, well, they found the place where the Buddha was born. I don't know if anybody saw that. There was this kind of thing, and this archaeological finding of Lumbini, and they sort of excavated and they found, oh, this is kind of new finding. We've got kind of conclusive, the first proof we've got of where the Buddha lived and all of these kinds of things. Actually, it was complete surfy, right? I mean, they basically found nothing. They found a couple of what might have been old fence posts or something like that, and assumed from that there was something there, and assumed that they could date it and all of these things. One of the problems with that was not merely the fact that it was an overstated claim, but it kind of gives you the impression that we don't have any idea when the Buddha lived, right? It gives you the impression that there's a vacuum, right? Oh, finally we've got something. No, it's not finally we've got something. Actually, we know where the Buddha was born because there's a huge pillar there carved by King Ashoka in perfectly clear letters that says twice, this is where the Buddha was born. Right? We're not sort of running around thinking, is there kind of some archaeological finding we can have to see where the Buddha was born, right? So, in fact, in a lot of cases, there are some quite good evidence for things, and there is I think very strong evidence to support the fact that the suttas came mostly from the Buddha. So of course we're not trying to support a fundamentalist view here. We're not arguing that every single word spoken in the suttas was spoken by the Buddha. Obviously it wasn't. There's all kinds of material in the suttas which doesn't even claim to be spoken by the Buddha, and background stories and teachings by various people and so on. So even of those materials which it claims to be spoken by the Buddha, we can very frequently discern the hand of editorial redaction and repetition and artificial construction of texts and so on and so forth. And so that's true, and it's important that we understand what the effect of any kind of editorial and redaction process would have on the text, right? That's one of the purposes of text critical studies. However, to move from that to say that we have no authentic texts is to forget the difference between composition and editing. Okay? It's a very different thing to write a text. Many of you will have written texts, many of you will have edited texts, and they're quite different kinds of things. Yeah? So editing, yes, can rearrange things, can standardize things, it can fix wordings and so on and so forth. But it's quite a different kind of thing from just making stuff up ad hoc. Okay, so I'd like this afternoon to be as interactive as possible, so if you've got any questions, please. Yes. What about the Buddha's bones? Well, the suttas are his bones, aren't they? Well, yes, there's some relics which were dug up from a couple of Attu and from Vaisali, which are possibly genuine relics of the Buddha's life. I don't know if there's been any carbon dating or anything like that of those, though. But they seem to have quite a good claim to be the relic from the Buddha. We mentioned those in the study. So what I might do... Sorry, go on, yeah. Of the Buddha's relics? I've never heard of any. Yeah, I don't know. But... yeah. Do you mean the Lumbini find? Or the... The Kapalabhata, well, they were excavated a long time ago, so it was a long time before they had carbon dating. I haven't heard that there's been any carbon dating on them. Maybe incorrect there. Yeah. Maybe, yeah. Yeah, maybe it's just considered too sacred to do carbon dating.
That's quite stupid.
They're stupid, okay. Well, we have an opinion here. Excellent.
Sacredness.
Well, I wouldn't. It wouldn't worry me. But what can I say?
Yeah. That would increase the authenticity.
It would do, of course. Yeah. But again, if you come from a skeptical point of view, you'd say, well, it just shows that it was bones of a person who lived at that time. Doesn't say anything else. But anyway, let's move ahead. That's not a bad example to use, though. One of the problems with this area is that any single fact you can in fact dismiss it, right? So let's say you got the relics of the Buddha from Kapalabhata and you did some carbon dating, you found it's from 2500 BC or something like that, or sorry, from 500 BC, then you could say, well, you know, that just proves that there was somebody alive at that. That way doesn't prove it was the Buddha and so on and so forth. So any specific piece of evidence, you can, of course, explain it away, right? And this is, of course, what the skeptics do. The problem with that is that of course you're explaining it away, but what are you achieving by explaining it away? I mean, it doesn't actually help you to understand things. Even in a scientific sphere, anybody who's worked in any kind of meaningful sphere of science, we know that facts can always be interpreted in different kinds of ways, right? So facts themselves don't tell a story. But what we do is we make up what we call a theory, which is essentially a story that makes sense of those facts. So the idea that the Buddha, that, you know, a spiritual teacher who lived 500 BC, who taught, his teachings had certain characteristics and that they were memorized and passed down by his students and so on. To me, this is the simplest and most rational explanation of the facts. Okay, so this is a table of contents, so just giving an idea of the kinds of things that we're looking at. If there's any particular areas of this authenticity that anybody's interested in, then please mention it and we can have a look at the things from that. It's not a sequential thing, it's just bits and, you know, different paragraphs on different topics. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. That's right, yeah. Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, that's another part of it. I mean, see, okay, so another aspect you mentioned, the kind of metaphysical questions or supposedly metaphysical questions, which I wouldn't call it metaphysical, but anyway, questions of rebirth and things like that. That's one of the areas that I think that the understanding the early Buddhist texts has a meaningful and valid role to play. And once again, of course, you don't prove that rebirth is true because it's spoken about in some text, right? On the other hand, if we take the early Buddhist texts seriously as being the teachings of the Buddha, then it's impossible to sort of argue away the fact that rebirth is very central to them, right? So again, how you interpret that is up to you, but certainly they are of great concern within the early Buddhist texts. So that would be one area, but it wasn't one of the things that we were focusing on at the time. And you could equally say that any other contentious area in Buddhism is equally challenged by the evidence within the early Buddhist texts, right? I mean, the early Buddhist texts completely undermine, for example, the whole Bodhisattva doctrine. Yeah? That's also highly contentious within Buddhism. It completely undermines, in my opinion, the whole Vipassana doctrine, right? It also completely undermines the whole ritualistic aspects of traditional Buddhism, right? And so on and so forth. It's difficult to find a form of Buddhism as practiced today that's not seriously challenged by what we find in the suttas. And so it should be. So the purpose isn't necessarily to challenge one or two particular things, but as a general challenge in the Buddhist world that we should always be looking back, asking, what is it that the Buddha taught? And what meaning does that have for us? And how does that cause us to interrogate our own practices, beliefs and traditions, and hopefully make them better?
So you're trying to focus exclusively on the evidence of historical precedents.
That's right. We're not getting into those kinds of issues here, where we're pointing to the evidence and we're saying, yeah, so yeah, yeah. That becomes, well, we perhaps could have done something like that in the conclusion, is indicate some areas where it has an impact, but we didn't we didn't get into that. Yeah. Okay, so this work, just read through the abstract quickly, this work articulates and defends a single thesis that the early Buddhist texts originated in the lifetime of the Buddha or a little later, because they were in the main spoken by the Buddha and his contemporary disciples. Can you read what's on the screen, by the way? Is that okay? This is the most simple, natural and reasonable explanation for the evidence. Our argument covers two main areas. First of all, the grounds for distinguishing the early Buddhist texts, EBTs, from latest Buddhist literature, and secondly, the evidence that the EBT stemmed from close to the Buddha's lifetime and that they were generally spoken by the historical Buddha. Most academic scholars of early Buddhism cautiously affirm that it is possible that the EBTs contain some authentic sayings of the Buddha. We contend that this drastically understates the evidence. A sympathetic assessment of relevant evidence shows that it's very likely that the bulk of the sayings in the EBTs that are attributed to the Buddha were actually spoken by him. It's very unlikely that most of these sayings are inauthentic. So this is that's our argument. So we gave acknowledgement to the supporters of the Buddhist Society of WA for helping us complete the project. Thank you, everybody. Okay. So I won't go. I'll skip over the introduction. I'll just go straight to the different arguments. One of the most of the arguments which we develop are not original, and in fact, almost everything that we are putting forward has been developed and cited by other scholars, and we give the citations there. There are some original contributions. The main one, I think, is we develop this idea of denialist Buddhism. And the term denialist Buddhism is, I think, it's deliberately meant as a challenge, and it's meant as a rebuttal to the term Protestant Buddhism, which was coined in the 1980s by Gregory Chopin. And Gregory Chopin is one of the probably the most influential of the skeptical scholars, and he, one of his criticisms of early Buddhist studies was that it was, he said, Protestant. So he said it was basically these Protestant scholars, like the German and English scholars who took up Buddhist studies and read into Buddhism the same ideas that they had from their Protestant backgrounds. And so in saying that, the Buddha was kind of a rational, scientific gentleman, they were essentially seeing themselves in the Buddhist texts. And this is kind of one argument which has been made I think it's a deeply flawed one, but one of the assumptions of the skeptical movement has been that the skeptical movement is sort of paints itself or depicts itself as being scientific, okay? That it's the kind of hard-nosed, evidence-based approach, right? Rather than believing that the suttas are spoken by the Buddha, which is kind of airy-fairy, kind of spiritual nonsense. That's kind of putting it into bald terms, but I think you get the idea that I'm coming from. Whereas in fact, I don't think that this skeptical point of view is scientific at all. In fact, I think it's abusing science and misusing science in a way that is similar to what we find with climate change denialists, creationists, or traced all the way back to the tobacco industry denialists, who were the originators of this kind of thing. And the same kinds of techniques that we find getting used. I'll look at that a little bit later, but the basic technique is to sow doubt, right? Well, it might not be, yeah? We don't know, yeah? More research is needed, yeah? And this, of course, was the refrain of the tobacco industry, the refrain of the creationists, the refrain of the climate change deniers, and it's also the refrain of the skeptics of Buddhist studies. So here's a timeline. So this is the rough chronology that we're working with, and this is more or less this is what's called the median chronology of the life of the Buddha, and these are the dates that are mostly worked with in modern scholars of early Buddhism. You'll notice that the traditional or the most widely accepted date for the death of the Buddha is 480 BC, but that's now regarded as more likely to be around the birth date of the Buddha, and the death of the Buddha, Buddha's Parinibbana, at around 400 BC. So the Buddha's dates have been shifted forward about 80 years, not on extremely firm grounds. We're still not very certain of when the Buddha's life was, but that seems to be the most, you know, sort of fit best with the evidence. Okay, so the dates have some significance. They're not really crucial for our argument, but it does help us to maintain the connections and understand the parallels with other historical changes that were happening at the time. And of course, the most significant of that would be that the date when Alexander the Great arrives in India, 326. So it's about 75 years or so after the time of the Buddha. Alexander the Great is there. Okay, so I'm just going to go through some of these arguments, and I'll just give you a bit of a taste for each one and have a bit of a discussion of each one, but please interrupt me at any time, and please, if you've got anything specific you want to discuss, then please bring it up. Okay, so the first one we bring up is the political geography. And I should just notice that we begin with, and we try to focus as much as we can on the concrete worldly things. We do discuss the doctrinal issues and so on a bit later on, but as philosophies are not as datable as buildings are, so we try to focus more on the concrete things rather than the philosophical issues. Okay, political geography of northern India changed rapidly after the period described in the EBTs. Within a few decades, the diverse kingdoms had been unified under the Nanda dynasty, a process that seemed beginning in the early Buddhist texts and which culminated in the Mauryan Empire of Chandragupta and Ashoka. The EBTs must consequently belong to a period of history at least several decades prior to the reign of the Nandas. This locates them at or very near the historical Buddha. Before discussing some of the major changes that occurred in this interval, we'll have a brief look at the main Greek source of knowledge of ancient India, the writings of Megasthenes. Megasthenes was the ambassador of the Greek king Seleucus I to Chandragupta's court at Pataliputta. His writing in India and those of other Greeks survive in quotations in Greek in works by classical Roman historians such as Arrian, Strabo and Pliny. The political and economic scene he depicts is broadly in agreement with the archaeological evidence for the Mauryan period, that is from Chandragupta and Ashoka, but postdates the descriptions in the EBTs. He describes the powerful kingdom of Magadha with its magnificent capital Pataliputta, which was an obscure village at the time of the EBTs. Chandragupta had inherited the vast dominions of the Nandas, and his empire was the grandest known in India until that time. So this is a very kind of important point. Megasthenes, you know, gives us a reliable and accurate record of the situation in Pataliputta around 100 years or so after the time of the Buddha, and the situation he's describing is completely different. The politics, the geography, all of that stuff is completely different from what is depicted in the suttas themselves. And the most obvious change is with Pataliputta, the capital city, a magnificent, huge, vast capital at that time. And he, you know, Augustine goes on at length describing how many war elephants they had and how huge the walls were and all of these kinds of things. And his descriptions of Pataliputta seem to be pretty accurate as far as we know. And yet, in the time of the Buddha, it was nothing. It was just a tiny, probably just a little fishing village, a collection of little houses on the mud flats by the Ganges. And of course, at the end of the Buddha's life, in the Mahapanibbana Sutta, we see that Pataliputta is starting to be developed and expanded by King Ajatasattu. And the growth of Pataliputta reflects the increasingly international orientation of the kingdoms at that time, that they were establishing their capital on the river. Okay, so it's on the center of the trade routes, and this is very significant. So it's the expansion of the trade routes along the Ganges, which signified the complete shift from being a small collection of warring kingdoms to being one great empire. Augustine doesn't refer directly to Buddhism, but he does notice the samanas and brahmins are essential figures of religious life in the EBTs. His description of samanas appears to be that of Jains or Ajivikas, although some of what he says may also apply to Buddhist monastics. Clement of Alexandria, around the 2nd century, connects Augustine's samanas with the Buddhists, saying among the Indians who are those philosophers who follow the precepts of Bhata, i.e. the Buddha, who they honour as a god on account of his extraordinary sanctity. Okay, so this is going into a bit more detail into that question of the expansion of the political sphere at the time. Most prominently featured in the EBTs are the countries within which the Buddha taught, a list of which is found in a few places in the suttas. The combined area of these countries is roughly equivalent to the central part of the Ganges plain. Occasionally this list is included to include other kingdoms, all of which are combined, known as the 16 great countries, Mahajanapada. These countries stretch as far as the northwest of India, including Gandhara. Apart from one EBT reference to Greeks and occasional reference to the Cambodians, possibly referring to the Persians, passages and areas outside of this region are typically mythological. South India and Sri Lanka are not mentioned at all and appear to be unknown. Apologies to all the Sri Lankans here. I'm sorry, but the Buddha did not go to Sri Lanka. I know. It's hard. What can I say? Aparantika to the west of India is regarded as a brutal, uncivilized place. Kalinga in the east is mentioned as a mythical wilderness in the Majjhima Nikaya, but as a civilized region in later passages. Andhra on the southeast is only mentioned in the Pali commentaries. So what's interesting about this is you can see that the areas in the center where the Buddha visited and that's featured, these are all regarded in quite ordinary, straightforward terms, right? This is where the Buddha walked through, this is where he stayed, this is the hut, and this is the river, and this is the hill, and so on. But as soon as you start to get out that, everything starts to become a bit mythical and a bit kind of unknown, and it's all described in the typical terms that you would describe all these uncivilized barbarians off in the Aparantika, and Kalinga is this strange wilderness, or even Uttarakuru, which is a sort of almost entirely mythical land to the north. And so this is showing how, you know, that's how the kind of your geographical imagination fades off, doesn't it? You know, you go from the known into the unknown, and you know, of course, in the old maps of the world, it's like here, there be dragons, right? And so that's what we're finding as you go outside of the Buddhist area, it's like here, there be dragons. And so that shows quite clearly that it doesn't just happen to be the case that these countries were mentioned and just an accident that those other countries weren't referred to. Yeah? On the contrary, what was referred to was basically the known world, and that was the area around the central Ganges Valley. Again, this being a radical shift. There's another passage in the Parayana Vagga mentioned there. But by the time of Chandragupta, a mere century after the Buddha, and even more so the time of Asoka, the known world had expanded to include Sri Lanka and, South India, possibly Burma, although Persia and possibly Greece too were known in India from an early period. Even prior to the EBTs, the knowledge of these different countries expanded in the Mauryan period. One of the Ashokan edicts mentions several Greek kings by name, indicating extensive knowledge of the Greek world. Right? So the areas that were either unknown or perhaps only mythically known in the time of the Buddha, by the time of Chandragupta and Asoka, were considered to be ordinary, and they had detailed knowledge of those things, political contacts, ambassadors, trade, and so on. Okay, so I want to look in a bit more detail at the Greek connections. It's of course been quite an interesting field of study, and the ancient connections between ancient Greece and ancient India were of course much more much stronger than we might imagine. There's only one known reference to the Greeks in the EBTs themselves. This comments on the different social structure of the Greeks, saying they did not have the four castes. The mention of the Greeks has been regarded as a late interpolation into the suttas at the time of Chandragupta. So this has been the argument. Again, notice how these kind of sceptical arguments will kind of go, oh yes, well this is mention of the Greeks, but that must indicate that it's added later, because we know that at the time of Chandragupta there was contact with Greeks, so it must have been added at that time. So certainly the relationship with the Greek world was a distant one at the time of the early Buddhist texts. However, there are several sources that mention or imply contact between Greeks and Indians at the time of the EBTs or even earlier. So Xerxes' Indica was written only a few years after the Buddha passed away. So this is a book on India called the Indica, written by a Greek and probably around 400 AD, so about the time of the Buddha died. Herodotus, contemporary of the Buddha, speaks of India many times and says that Indian troops fought in the Persian army of Xerxes. Thus, Indian troops fought against continental Greece at the beginning of the 5th century BC. The Persian emperor Cyrus I had in fact conquered parts of northwestern India as early as the mid-6th century BCE, and the territorial expansion into India along the Indus continued under Darius I in the late 6th century. According to Machiavelli, the vast Persian empire, and especially its capital Persepolis functioned as a cosmopolitan meeting place for people from different distant countries, including Greeks and Indians. There's certainly abundant reason to think that there could be some knowledge of the Greek realm, even in the time of the Buddha. Chandragupta's reign, by contrast, marks a period of close contact with the Greeks. Chandragupta had a Greek ambassador at his court, probably married a Greek princess. Again, something which is kind of not widely known. You think about the implications of this. Chandragupta married a Greek princess. He was Ashoka's grandfather. Ashoka was part Greek. He was Mahinda's father and Sanghamitta's father. Therefore, Buddhism in Sri Lanka was established by the Greeks. Therefore, this is the Greek branch of Buddhism. Bet you didn't know that. When I went to Anuradhapura over the New Year period, I saw at in the great stupa there in the Mahavihara, they had the story of the founding of the great stupa, and it mentioned that the founding of it was attended by Yonika Dhammarakita. This is about 2nd century BC, and it mentions the name Yonika Dhammarakita. Yonika, of course, meaning Greek. Right, so Greek Dhammarakita was there at the founding of the great stupa in Anuradhapura. It's about the time of King Ashoka, maybe a little bit later than King Ashoka. And that's mentioned in the Pali Chronicles, Mahavamsa and so on as well. So that made me feel a little bit less lonely when I was there. Ah, there were Western monks here more than 2,000 years ago. Okay. So Ashoka mentions the Greeks. Okay, so according to the EBTs, the north of India at the time of the Buddha was divided into 16 great countries, one of which was Magadha. This tradition is echoed in the Jaina and Brahmanical sources, which however give a somewhat distant list of countries. Where they differ, the EBT list appears to be earlier. while these 16 nations are only mentioned occasionally, the political situation that they represent of northern India, divided into a patchwork of minor principalities and republics, is inherent to the entire socio-political environment of the EBTs. And I want to emphasize this point. It's not that there's an occasional mention of a group of countries or something like that that we find in the suttas, right? Of course there is that, right? But that the whole, it's just assumed throughout the suttas that this situation is there, and there's constant references to King Pasenadi or King Jatasattu or King Bimbisara wandering from this country to that country, and the different tribes and cities and so on and so forth are named and mentioned and discussed on countless times. And it's that kind of embodied information which is extremely difficult to create or adapt at a later period of time, right? It's easy enough to change one passage, right? So they might take these 16 countries and add a country or delete a country or change it, right? So you can change one particular passage. But that kind of embedded knowledge, which is just a background to all of the stories, it's not the kind of thing which you can really fake without being extremely sneaky. Yeah, okay. So the Buddha mentions the four great oceans, but again, the mention of the oceans is always somewhat vague, isn't it? Yeah, so there's always a slightly mythological there. The ocean is always used as a simile for something measureless. Right? So that means we don't know what's on the other side of it. Yeah. But that's four is always kind of a number of completion in Buddhism. So it's like, you know, all of the oceans all around in all directions. Yeah. Well, again, clearly the knowledge was around. But again, the situation, I mean, obviously there would have been some seagoing transport at that time, but it's not prominent at all. But from the time of Chandragupta and Ashoka, it became extremely prominent. I found a lot of stories mentioning, like in the Jatakas and this kind of thing, mentioning trade and so on. You know, even you look in the Jatakas, even the first story in the first series, I think the first 10 stories or something like that, is all about traders in the Jataka book. And I think that's very significant. Now, this is where a lot of these stories come from, is from, you know, being disseminated along these trade routes and so on. There's even one of the Jatakas is called the Bhaveru Jataka. It's about trading with Babylon. And basically, the idea is that when they got on their ship to Babylon, they had a crow which had hitched a ride on the ship, and the Babylonians had never seen a crow before. And they were like, wow, this thing's amazing. It's like really precious. You know, we have to pay a lot. We'll give you lots of gold for it. How much is it worth? And so they sell all this crow for all this money, and they're rubbing their hands. They're thinking, right, we're going to go back and get some peacocks. And of course, peacocks was one of the big trades at the time. Anyway, so here's a map of the area, and this is showing the area. The countries that are mentioned there are the 16 Mahajanapadas, and you can see this is mainly focusing around this area where the Buddha, this is the main area the Buddha stayed in, Magadha, Kosala, and so on, around there. And occasionally he went up as far as the Kuru country, and around here. Yeah. The furthest west in the suttas we get is to Avanti, Aparantika, is around here. Okay, so this is really kind of the main extent of the suttas, and the suttas are quite aware of Kamboja and Gandhara, but not really sort of going there very much, but that's there, down to Asaka being the furthest south. Kalinga is only mentioned in the later commentaries, so you can see in the time of Ajatasattu, the Magadhan realm was probably somewhere around here. Okay, so this is at the end of the Buddha's life. So it had, even earlier in the Buddha's life, it was actually, at the beginning of the Buddha's life, it was somewhat smaller. So Magadha itself would have been around about here. And early on in the Buddha's life, Bimbisara conquered Anga, so it expanded out there to the east. And then towards the end of the Buddha's life, they conquered Kasi, so it expanded out there to the west. So that process of expanding Magadha was going on during the Buddha's lifetime, okay? And notice the meaning of that expansion, okay, it's not just random expansion, but because Anga is going south, sorry, he's going east along the Ganges, and to expand in Kasi is going west along the Ganges, okay? So they're unifying the Ganges, yeah? This is a huge deal, right? So when they can do that, then they open up all of these trade routes. And this was one of the great trade routes in India, they call the Uttarapatha, the Northern Road, okay? And one of the ancient schools of Buddhism called the Uttarapataka school of Buddhism, literally the Norwegians, okay, on the Norway, so the Uttarapataka. Yeah. So I always joke that Venerable Brahmali is from the Uttarapataka school. And the Northern Way, and then the Southern Way, the Dakinapata, down here. Okay. And so, of course, when the trade routes open up by land up here to Persia and China, and from sea down here across. And this was establishing the sea routes was one of the great purposes of Alexander's journey. So Alexander came down, hit the Nanda Empire around here, and then travelled down to the coast and mapped out the coastline. So this is a situation at the time of the Buddha's passing away. These ones had been unified under Magadha, all the rest of them still more or less independent. By the time of the Nanda Empire, then we have this, okay, that whole area. So it's actually all of that known area is now included within one region. And that happened very soon after the Buddha's passing away. We don't know any details about it. Where the Nandas are only referred to in a few places. We don't know how they became so powerful or anything like that. But they had conquered all of those 16 kingdoms. And we know that there's an inscription in Kalinga mentioning that the Nandas had been there and done irrigation works there. And we know that Alexander was turned back by the Nandas up here near the Kuru country. So we know, based on quite hard facts, that the empire must have extended roughly that far and around 50 years or perhaps a little bit later after the time of the Buddha. But we don't know much more about it. And of course, a couple of generations after that, about 100 years after the Buddha, then India is then united in the Mauryan Empire under Chandragupta. So even though from a Buddhist point of view we often regard King Ashoka as being the greatest king, and of course from a Dhammic point of view he was, the size and magnificence of his empire was largely inherited, and Chandragupta's empire already stretched up here to the far west, here to the east, and down to the south of India. Kalinga was a kind of disputed area. Kalinga was apparently conquered by the Nandas, lost at a later date, and then reconquered by King Ashoka. So under Chandragupta didn't have the Kalinga region. So it really is, I mean, it really is amazing to think of that kind of transformation and the speed of it. And the fact that not a single hint of that transformation has found its way into any area, any part of the early Buddhist texts. Absolutely, yeah. That's right, I think at the time it probably would have been the biggest empire in the world, yeah. I mean, it depends how you count the Greek empires, because they sort of were unified under Alexander and then sort of split up. That was kind of complicated, but certainly it was one of, if not the biggest empire in the world, yeah. Again, at that time, that had been conquered by the Greeks. So, yeah, so the Greeks sort of, after Alexander died, they kind of divided the empire up between them, so, yeah. But look, and you know, of course, that was almost the last time that India was unified until the British came along, right? I mean, there were a few periods under the Mughal empires and so on where it was fairly unified, but that was pretty much the last time it was unified, and especially that it was unified under a native Indian ruler. Yeah. Which is why, of course, the Ashoka's wheel is still on the Indian flag. Okay. Okay, so that's... That I also mentioned, already mentioned the transformation of Pataliputta. One... Okay. So another one of the arguments which has been used frequently by scholars is the fact that there's no mention of Chandragupta, and especially of King Ashoka, in the early Buddhist texts. And this is something we find throughout all of the later strata of literature, right? All of the histories and chronicles and things like that will always mention King Ashoka, and the temptation to include a reference to Ashoka in the early suttas must have been very great, right? I mean, again, it would be quite easy to compose a sutta that where the Buddha gave a prediction of a great Dhamma king who would arise in 200 years' time and become a universal emperor and so on and so forth, right? It's very easy to fake suttas, okay? They got these standard beginnings and endings, and you can put these top phrases in there and stuff, so it's quite easy to fake them if you want to. But they didn't. There's not a single mention to Chandragupta or Ashoka, even though these kinds of things are found regularly in the later literature. Okay. Okay, so another one of the things which is... another one of these kind of embedded knowledge is the social condition at the time as found in the suttas. In contrast to the Brahmanas and Upanishads, which portray rural socio-economic conditions, the EBTs depict an urban life with flourishing trade as to political situation. Although small-scale state formation can be traced to the Upanishads, it's only in the Buddhist literature that regional development and struggles between kings are depicted. Again, that kind of fitting well between the period of the Upanishads and the later Ashokan period. Economic conditions and trade. In EBTs, we rarely find mention of trade outside the Ganges plain. Even luxury goods such as fine cloth were produced locally, especially in Kasi or Varanasi, and then traded within northern India. There are some exceptions to this. Kasi sandalwood, which was used by the upper strata of society, including kings, most likely originated in southern India, but was processed in Kasi. This situation is perhaps to be expected given the political divisions in northern India at the time, which may have complicated long-distance trade. There's only one mention of the existence of seagoing merchants in the EBTs, but nothing is said of where they traded. This picture fits with the scant historical information available for this time. According to McCrindle, Niarchos's, not sure if that's how you pronounce it. Anyone who knows ancient Greek, please correct my pronunciation. A coastal voyage from the mouth of the Indus to the Persian Gulf undertaken at the behest of Alexander the Great was done with the express purpose of gathering information about this stretch of coast, and it resulted in the opening up of communication between Europe and Asia. This indicates that seafaring in this area, including sea trade, would have been very limited even 100 years after the Buddha. The picture given by the EBTs and the Crindle contrasts with the situation in India at the time of Ashoka, who ruled only a few decades after Alexander. By this time, we hear of trade between India and far-off regions such as the Mediterranean. This situation matches quite well with trade as depicted in the Buddhist Jataka literature, which is normally assigned to a period in the centuries after the Buddha. The Jatakas mentioned trade by sea to Suvarnabhumi, Lower Burma, and also over the desert to Suvira, Rajasthan, and Baveru to Babylon. So this is, again, I think quite an important argument, again, to notice what kind of text that we're talking about. When, say, Siddhartha, when the Buddha was talking about his upbringing as Prince Siddhartha, you know, he would say, oh, we lived this life of great luxury, right? And he'd say, you know, it's so luxurious. We used, like, Kasi sandalwood and Kasi cloth. Like, this was, like, the height of luxury, right? And so he's saying, you know, we used Chanel and... I don't even know what are the other brands and things, whatever the rich brands are, I don't know them, Giorgio Armani or whatever. These were the, you know, this is what we all had, right? And he's trying to impress you and say that's how rich they were, because they had things from all the way in Kasi, right? Which actually is, you know, is actually just a neighbouring province, really. And so if they'd had silks from China or, you know, luxuries from Rome or something like that, then surely they would have mentioned it. So the universal monarch. The EBTs refer occasionally to the notion of the Chakravarti, a universal wheel-turning emperor who rules from sea to sea, justly without violence. Since there's no evidence for a pan-Indian empire before the Buddha, it's sometimes argued that this idea must date from Ashokan times. Again, this being one of the ideas put forward by the skeptics. But this conclusion is unwarranted. The Mauryan Empire probably had a different structure from the one connected to the Chakravarti ideal, according to which vassal kings were ruled by the universal monarch. Indeed, the Chakravarti is clearly a mythic figure and an imagined ideal that sits ill with the realistic stories of Ashoka and his ambiguous relation to violence. Also, Ashoka claims many titles for himself, and Chakravarti is not one of them. Moreover, the Chakravarti is also found in Jaina sutras, and there's no evidence that Jains had a close relationship with Ashoka in the way that the Buddhists did. Rather, the antecedent for the Chakravarti, and personally I find this quite interesting, this idea is that the ancient Brahmanical horse sacrifice, the Ashvamedha, which establishes sovereignty from ocean to ocean. And so the Ashvamedha is described in quite detail in the pre-Buddhist Brahmanical texts, notably in the Briharanyaka, which predates the Buddha by only a couple of hundred years and is largely set in the same place as the Buddha lived. And so such a notion would have arisen through both the magnification of the glories of former Aryan realms and by comparison with the powerful contemporary Persian Empire. The Buddha appropriated the Vedic myth, removed the violent and coarse aspects, which in the original version of the Ashvamedha, the horse sacrifice, are indeed extremely violent and extremely coarse, and he retained the ethical ideal of righteous rule. And so there's various specific parallels between the Chakravarti and the horse sacrifice, some of which I put here. The horse treasure of the Chakravarti is white with a black head, while the sacrificial horse in the Ashvamedha is white with a black head and forequarters, and so on and so forth, other details. To me, that's a very striking detail. It's certainly no accident that the horse has that very distinctive colouring, both in the Buddhist ideal of the Chakravarti and in the Ashvamedha. Okay, so I won't go through all of those ones. So the situation with writing, I might skip over that. If anyone wants to talk about that, they can. Religious context. Again, this I think being quite an important thing and something which is often overlooked and something which we don't make conscious when we're reading the suttas, the significance of it. The EBTs frequently depict the Buddha and his disciples in dialogue with members of other religions and with skeptics. This is radically different from all other Buddhist literature, which consists almost entirely of Buddhists speaking to other Buddhists. This difference makes sense if we consider that the EBTs largely stemmed from the life of the founder, one of whose tasks was to persuade others to his path. Okay? And this is, I think, a radical difference. The suttas constantly doing interfaith dialogue. Right? In the Digha Nikaya, almost every sutta is, in fact, the Buddha discussing with Brahmins and wanderers and so on. And the Majjhima Nikaya, it happens all the time. And where do you find that happening anywhere in any later Buddhist literature? Right? I honestly can't think of a single example of kind of meaningful text or something that's about a debate between Buddhists and non-Buddhists. Even those texts that have debates, like the Kadavattu or the Melinda Panha and other ones, are debates among Buddhists about interpretations of Buddhist ideas and not with non-Buddhists, which I think is unfortunate. So obviously in the time of the Buddha, he wasn't living in a Buddhist culture. Right? He was living in a very diverse religious culture and so had very diverse dialogue. So the Buddhist texts depict the Buddha as contemporary with Mahavira, the teacher of the Jains, and the Jain tradition places Mahavira at 599 to 257 BCE, which agrees roughly with the traditional Theravadan dating of the Buddha, and even though these dates aren't historically precise, this does show that both the Jain and Buddhist texts indicate that the teachers flourished in the same pre-Mauryan period. Moreover, the early Buddhist texts in the Jaina literature show a number of similarities. Even though the language of the extant Jaina literature stems from a later date, this suggests that the two literary traditions are rooted in roughly the same period. We have to be, of course, very cautious about the conclusions we draw from this, because unfortunately the Jaina literature is much later than the Buddhist, although it might have some early sections to it. But here's a bunch of things that we share in common with the Jaina literature: criticism of animal sacrifice, some of the ideas around karma's importance of generosity, the criticism of the caste system, the idea of the Pacheka Buddha, including some of the same names of Pacheka Buddhas, And so on and so on. There's one sutta which is shared in common between the Buddhist and Jaina sources, the Payasi Sutta, which is a fantastic sutta. The different shared similes, similar religious vocabulary, verses shared in common, stylistic parallels, and so on and so forth. And as well the basic moral teachings of the early Buddhist texts and early Jain texts are similar, including the basic precepts, not killing, stealing, lying, or indulging in sensory pleasures. So these, there's a large mass of ideas and so on, which is shared between Buddhism and Jainism. Not being conclusive, that does point to or indicate that they emerged in a similar kind of social situation, similar historical period. If we turn to the other great religious tradition in the time of the Buddha was Brahmanism. A number of facts about the EBTs help us to locate them in time vis-a-vis the Brahmanical text. The EBTs refer only to three Vedas, not to the four that became standard in later years. And they are unaware of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, which are of a later date. The EBTs depict uncertainty and questioning among the Brahmins, which is highly characteristic of the early pre-Buddhist Upanishads. Right, so this idea that there was a culture of uncertainty and questioning and change within the Brahmanical tradition is very strikingly found in the early Upanishads, especially in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishads. One of the things that was pointed out many years ago by Thomas Rhys Davids was that many of the most profound and memorable insights in the Upanishadic tradition were first introduced by the Kshatriyas, not by the Brahmins. Okay, so there are debates between Brahmin priests and the Kshatriyas, and it's the Kshatriyas who win the debates and have the most profound insight into the nature of Brahman. So this is actually a very interesting perspective on the change within that tradition which was happening at that time, a little bit before the Buddha and during the time of the Buddha. While the EBTs are aware of Upanishadic ideas, they only name the Upanishads once as Brahmanical lineages rather than as texts. So this is something which is a little bit controversial, the relationship between the Upanishads and the suttas. One might expect that the suttas would have a kind of more clear and explicit knowledge of the Upanishads than they in fact demonstrate. However, it does seem as if the Upanishads, as the name Upanishad suggests, were secret or esoteric texts. Right? Upanishad means sitting close to. Right? And so the idea that there was something you learnt in close connection with the teacher rather than something being a broadly known text. In any case, there are a lot of connections between the ideas you find in the suttas and the Upanishadic ideas. We mentioned a few of them here in the footnote, such phrases as eso hamasmi, being very similar to the Brahmanical phrase tatvangasi, and so on, so atta, so loko, the self is the same as the cosmos, be very characteristic of Brahmanical Upanishadic ideas. And one place in the suttas where there's mention of these different Brahmins who are identified with these particular Upanishads, the Adharya, the Taittiriya, Chandogya, and the Brihadaranyaka Upanishads. The EBTs, another important point is that the EBTs are unaware of Panini, who can be dated no later than the mid 4th century BCE. So Panini, according to the experts, lived only a little bit after the Buddha, probably in the century that Chandragupta, a bit before Chandragupta. And this can be seen in the fact the EBTs frequently refer to grammar, but as an ancient tradition, not as a modern innovation. And to be unaware of or not mention Panini would seem to be extraordinary. Panini's accomplishment is, I think, one of the great intellectual achievements of humanity. His grammar, he just came along and just killed it, right? He just came along and said, this is grammar, this is what how language is made, and bingo, there it is, and nobody's done it better since his time. He basically nailed it on the first time out. So, he was obviously drawing on a long and rich history of grammar and linguistic studies, but he created this incredibly difficult, sophisticated, and precise grammatical system, which has been the basis for Indian language studies ever since, yet not mentioned anywhere in the suttas. The Panini is actually one of the people who's discussed in discussions of whether there was writing in the time of the Buddha, because a lot of people find it extremely difficult to believe that Panini could have composed his literature orally. His text is so complex and so sophisticated that it seemed that it would have to be written. Perhaps that's just displaying the lack of imagination of modern scholars who are not used to working with oral text. Anyway, the EBTs also depict many deities and practices that are found neither in the ancient Vedas nor in the later Hinduism. In addition, they fail to mention many practices common to the later Brahmanical traditions, such as the worship of the Shiva Lingam, deities such as Krishna, Ganesh, Kali and Skanda. So again, the early Buddhist texts clearly depicting an earlier stage of development of the Indian religions. Yeah. Okay.
That would suggest that he was actually close to an oral tradition, like that he was not that far away from a purely oral culture, because that's the first thing you do when you transcribe
right.
oral cultures.
Yeah, okay, so an interesting suggestion, because Panini includes prosody in his grammar. Yes, I mean, I think, obviously, his primary interest within that tradition was the Vedas, which, of course, are verse, so that's being very important within that tradition. But, yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that Panini was close to oral tradition. And so I guess the question, I mean, he's a figure who's a little bit like Homer or something like that, you know. He's kind of probably a real person, probably lived at that time, but also is kind of mythological, obviously drawing on an oral tradition. But codifying it in a way that became remembered. Yeah. Okay. Is that one? Okay. So textual transmission. So one of the questions is. If the Buddha taught, if there was somebody called the Buddha, then what do we know about how these texts were handed down? How reliable was that transmission? What were the methods? How did that all go about? So we do a bit of an overview of the situation with the textual transmission. Now, obviously we're dealing with an oral literature, and one of the basic skeptical arguments that people use is to say, well, it's an oral literature, it wasn't written down, therefore I don't know what the conclusion is, therefore you can make stuff up or whatever. But there's, as far as I'm aware, no one has ever made any substantive argument or shown any evidence whatsoever that an oral tradition is any less reliable than a written tradition, right? I've never seen any evidence to that effect. It's extremely easy to fake written texts and to change them. It happens all the time, right? Whereas oral texts, it's quite possible to remember and maintain oral texts extremely accurately for long periods of time. We know that happened with the Rig Veda. Anyway, okay. So here, a comparative argument, we possess EBTs from a substantial variety of ancient Indian schools, including Mahavihara, the modern-day Theravada of Sri Lanka, the Dharmaguptaka, Mahasanghika, Mahishasaka, Mula Sarvastivada, Sarvastivada, and others of uncertain affiliation. A century of detailed study has consistently shown that they are essentially identical in doctrine, irrespective of transmission lineage. The great Belgian scholar Etienne Lamotte says, with the exceptions of the Mahayanist interpretations in the Akotara, which are easily discernible, a very important point, the variations in question across the lines of transmission hardly affect anything except the method of expression or the arrangement of the subjects. The doctrinal basis common to the Agamas and Nikayas is remarkably uniform. And this is in stark contrast to the non-EBT texts. Important point that Lamotte makes is that it's easy to discern the later additions and variations. And this is also something which is, I think, ignored or sidelined by the critics, who say, well, we don't know what could have been added and what could have been changed and so on and so forth. But in fact, we have many examples of things which were in fact changed and added. And they are usually very easy to spot, because there are multiple converging signs that these things are later. And I'll give you maybe an example of that later on. Okay, so the basic facts were discovered in the 19th century, Again, not many people know how far back these comparative studies have gone. In 1859, Samuel Beale published side-by-side translations of the Pali Parimokkha and the Dharmaguptaka Pratimoksha in Chinese, showing their virtually identical content. He noted that the identity of the code in both cases therefore seems to be established. In 1882, Samuel Beale described detailed correspondences between suttas in Chinese and Pali and accurately predicted that when the Vinaya and Agama collections are thoroughly examined, I can have little doubt that we shall find most, if not all, the Pali suttas in Chinese form. And so that gives a bit of detail as to the scholarly development since then, but essentially we've seen that, that's been confirmed. Now, what are the implications of that? Well, obviously that the fact that the teachings of the schools are essentially identical allows us to say that, well, they probably haven't changed very much in the time since those schools have existed. Now, those schools have been around for probably 2,200, maybe 2,300 years, okay? They don't take us back to the time of the Buddha, right? So the schools emerge maybe 100 or 200 years after the Buddha, 100, 200, 300 years, something like that. So you could argue that, well, that doesn't tell us anything about what that was in the time of the Buddha. But again, I would say that this is not a rational argument. Okay? A rational argument proceeds from known facts and infers from what we know to what we don't know. Right? So if we know that the text hardly changed at all over 2,300 years, the most rational conclusion is that they also didn't change very much over 2,500 years. Okay? Now, that doesn't prove that they didn't change, right? Obviously, they did change to some degree, but it's the simplest and most rational explanation of the facts. And so unless you've got a good reason to think that they've changed, then I would argue that, the most reasonable conclusion is that the tradition was highly conservative from the beginning, and that they saw very clearly that their mission was to preserve the words of the Buddha. And they were clearly able to mobilize a large amount of resources and effort and intelligence and integrity to be able to do that as best as they could. Yeah.
Who resurrected the Lotus Sutra. He lived in 1222
okay.
to 1280,
uh-huh.
and we study the Lotus Sutra, and my understanding is that that was the final sutra of the Buddha,
uh-huh.
and his last sutra, and it was the only sutra where women were actually allowed to become disciples. Now, I don't know.
What,
can you comment
true.
On that, please?
Okay. Well, the Lotus Sutra is the Mahayana Sutra, so that comes from a substantially later period than any of the texts that we're talking about here. So we're talking about the early Buddhist texts, which are found in the Pali scriptures and also in the Chinese Agama and other literature. Okay. So the Mahayana Sutras began to be composed around 500 years after the Buddha. Okay. Now, obviously, they're drawing upon knowledge and so on within the Buddhist community at the time, right? But generally that's the period of composition. The Lotus Sutra is usually dated around 2nd century AD, okay? So, you know, of course within the Mahayana tradition it's believed to be the literal word of the Buddha, but that's not accepted in academic circles. Regarding the idea that it's the only type of place where women are allowed to become disciples, that's just not true. The women are depicted as being disciples of the Buddha all the way through the early Buddhist texts, so I'm not quite sure what that was in reference to.
Yeah. I don't know because I'm not a scholar.
Yeah.
But I was just interested to hear, you know, from you. You are a scholar, so I wanted to hear from you.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what they exactly mean by that. There might be something more specific that they're referring to, but generally speaking, yes, in the early Buddhist texts, and the women are constantly being referred to as students and disciples and quite advanced practitioners. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. look, there is something else, and this is very departing from what you're talking about today, but when I went to the Jay Buddha to see the Jay Buddha when it came to Perth, there were captions about the Buddha all the way through, and on his birth, about his birth, they said that his mother, the queen, was touched by an elephant's trunk, and that was when she became pregnant. And in the Bible, it says that Mary was touched by an angel, and she became pregnant. And I just want to, you know, like, have you got any knowledge on that either that I'd like to know about?
Well, I don't know. I kind of get the feeling that monks aren't perhaps the best authorities on how childbirth comes about.
No, but what how it affects me is that almost as if natural copulation between human beings isn't divine, isn't acceptable when it comes to these, you know, the Buddha and Jesus and all
of course,
this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's part of this tradition of deifying the Buddha and removing him from being a human being who was an exemplar, a spiritual practitioner, a leader and a teacher, and turning him into some kind of divine being, and that's kind of part of that process. I mean, that similarity, incidentally, was noticed by the early Christian and Roman philosophers who actually referred to the Buddha in the controversies of the virgin birth of Jesus. So this is something that was quite well known in the ancient world. Like Clement of Alexandria, I think, referred to it. So, well, that's not unusual, is it? That's right. Not only did they get enlightened, and then the Buddha, and she died after 7 days. But not only that, finally, when the Buddha did go to see her, right, he taught her the Abhidhamma, right. So she had to sit there for months listening to these really boring Abhidhamma talks. I don't know if that was meant as a talk. Right, I mean, all this is part of the kind of later legend, right, so we don't take it too seriously, but I do believe that the idea that the Buddha's mother passed away shortly after he was born, I do believe that that's probably historically valid, yeah? Obviously, it was extremely common for women to die in childbirth, as it still is today, shockingly, we know that the Buddha, you know, referred to his stepmother Mahapajapati later on, so I think that's actually very likely that was based on a historical fact.
So even the life of Buddha isn't perfect.
Well, yeah. I mean, you kind of wonder about the psychological impact, right? A young infant whose mother gets withdrawn suddenly, and then his teaching later on is all that's beloved and pleasing will pass away from you. Anyway. Eddie. The purpose is to discuss early Buddhist texts, not to discuss the Mahayana texts, but anyway, yeah. Yes, but the early Buddhist texts are not just the Pali texts, but they are also the Chinese Agamas, there's texts found in every Buddhist tradition, which come from the early Buddhist, from the period of the early Buddhism, yeah? So what we consider to be the early Buddhist texts is not just the Pali tradition, but it's based on whatever has those characteristics of being early. Yeah, so there are Chinese texts, Tibetan, Sanskrit, and so on. From the time of the Buddha, and a bit later, Okay, I'll just give one more argument here before going on to look at the conclusion, but this is about the argument of later borrowing, and this is curiously influential argument, which has been repeated and relied on a number of times in different academic studies and so on, and I've got no idea why. I've never found it faintly plausible. But Gregory Chopin, in one of his essays written in the 80s, suggests that the shared content of the EBTs may be due to later borrowing, levelling and standardisation. And so this is one of these kinds of things where Chopin sort of throws out these ideas kind of in an offhand manner without really bothering to provide any kind of evidence for it at all, as if, you know, he's just throwing out an idea to, you know, and it gets 10 or 20 years later, you find that it's almost accepted as some kind of axiom of what must have happened. Anyway, as recently shown by Venerable Amalia, there's no evidence for this. At the same time, there's much evidence to the contrary. Moreover, the thesis of a shared origin is simpler, more natural, and more powerful than that of a later borrowing. Alexander Wynne has given some very specific examples where later borrowing is very unlikely to have taken place, especially where incidental details are found shared between totally distinct types of texts, or when the shared material, though irrelevant to any point of Buddhist doctrine, is counter to the usual sort of presentation. But the argument against later borrowing is not limited to a few specific examples. Consider the Vinaya. Here we have a clearly demarcated text where the Patimokkha, that's the list of rules, is obviously older than the Vibhanga material that surrounds it. The Patimokkha is almost identical across every school, while the Vibhanga material is substantially different. If the later borrowing thesis were correct, one would not expect this difference in standardization between Patimokkha and Vibhanga. Thus, the shared origin thesis is confirmed. This is not just a characteristic of the Vinaya, but applies to every Buddhist text that we have available for comparison. The Abhidhammas of various schools, to give another example, diverge far more than the EBTs, but what they have in common is especially those passages that quote the EBTs. Moreover, we have many examples of actual borrowing among non-EBTs, and these compare very differently from parallel texts among the EBTs. For instance, the Buddhist legend shows many signs of later borrowings between the schools. We were just talking about the Buddha's legend, the idea that he walked on lotuses and was, you know, born from a dream of an elephant and these kinds of things. These are sharings of ideas, episodes and motifs, not the massive sharing of thousands of nearly identical texts which would be required to explain the existence of the early Buddhist texts by means of borrowing. Likewise, the Jatakas and many other Buddhist stories frequently appear to be borrowed among the traditions, but the resulting similarities are quite different than those found in the EBTs. In the realm of philosophy, we also find borrowing, for example, key Abhidhammic ideas such as Swabhava, Swalakshana and Samanyalakshana are shared between the Pali, Sarvasivadin and other Abhidhamma systems and are defined in similar ways, and yet the texts and philosophies in which the terms appear differ widely depending on the school. Okay, so this is an argument against this whole idea of later borrowing being the explanation for the similarity of the early Buddhist texts and so on. So I can't go on too much to talk about all of these details. We're approaching the kind of the end, but I might just discuss a little bit on the conclusion, which is the the idea of denialist Buddhism and the what that idea is all about. So I'm just trying to find denialist Buddhism. Okay, so scientific characteristics. The theory of authenticity has many characteristics of a scientific theory which the theory of inauthenticity lacks. While there is no complete agreement on what constitutes a scientific theory, there's a number of well-recognized characteristics. The theory that the early Buddhist texts are authentic fulfills these criteria, while the theory that the early Buddhist texts are inauthentic does not. Okay, so here we're kind of issuing, we're not being defensive, we're sort of going on the offense and saying that this criticism is not really scientific, it's not really based on rational grounds. So falsifiability. The theory of authenticity may be easily falsified. That is, it's a risky theory in Popperian terms. For example, a single epigraphic reference to a Mahayana sutra dated to the 4th or 5th century BCE would conclusively refute the theory of authenticity. On the other hand, it's not easy to see how the theory of authenticity could be falsified even in principle, still less in practice. Such theorists argue that we do not know, or that the evidence may be incomplete, or that there may have been a systematic removal of texts. This is one of the arguments which is developed by Gregory Chopin, that there's a kind of massive conspiracy to change things in order to create these things. That's all a bit balmy, but anyway. Since all empirical knowledge is uncertain, incomplete, or subject to distortion, such objections can never be finally refuted. Another characteristic of a scientific theory is plasticity. A good theory is refined and improved when new evidence or arguments come to light. Examples with the theory of authenticity include the date of the historical Buddha, whether Pali was the Buddha's language, whether the original texts were the same as the Pali, an unknown oral canon, or a more loosely defined body of texts. By contrast, the proponents of the theory of inauthenticity, despite repeated criticism by experts in the field, have not substantially changed or adapted their arguments. Another interesting one is predictive power. Right, so a scientific theory should be able to predict things, otherwise it's not very much use. Right? So the theory of authenticity has accurately predicted many subsequent developments in the field. We've already referred to Samuel Beal's prediction. Another example is the archaeological discoveries by Alexander Cunningham. He didn't have the Pali or the other early Buddha texts available to him, but using the Greek sources, the Hindu Puranas, and especially the work of the Chinese pilgrim Xuanzang as his guide, he was able to locate many of the sites referred to in the early Buddhist texts. While more detailed work has necessitated subsequent revision of some of his findings, he was able to successfully map out the overall geography of ancient India, and most of his relevant identifications have been confirmed by positive archaeological identifications. A further example is the relative dating of the books of the Pali Canon by Rhys Davids, a list that has been mostly corroborated by subsequent studies. So at the late 19th century, scholars like Rhys Davids and others developed this way of stratifying the books in the Pali Canon and saying these ones are early, these ones are medium, these ones are late, and mostly that framework is still what we use today. So on and so forth. So these are different characteristics of a scientific theory which we discuss and which we argue are similar to found within the theory of authenticity. The theory of authenticity is similar to inductive theories in the classical sense in that it uses observations of particulars to test, correct and improve general hypotheses, which in turn suggest avenues for further investigation of research. One of the characteristics of such theories is that they are probabilistic and hence are much better at establishing generalities than specifics. This problem is well known in the case of global warming. The theory cannot predict whether any specific day will be hot or cold, but it can say with a high degree of probability that there will be more and more hot days in coming years. Similarly, while we cannot say with any certainty that a specific text was literally spoken by the historical Buddha, we can say with a high degree of probability that the texts as a whole stem from him. This distinction is one of the rhetorical fault lines in the discussion of authenticity. Skeptics assert that we can't know for certain whether any specific phrase is spoken by the Buddha, while advocates affirm that the doctrinal teachings as a whole must come from him. While the skeptical assertion is true, it's trivially so, and has no real effect on our understanding of the status of the texts. Okay, so I'm going to discuss that in some more, and then we'll look at this notion of denialist Buddhism. Critics of early Buddhism have adopted a rhetoric of skepticism in order to dismiss the notion of authenticity. Their arguments are apparently intended to be hard-nosed and unsentimental, but when examined closely, they are reminiscent of arguments by denialists of various types, such as those relating to the harmful effects of tobacco, creationism, or the reality of man-made climate change. Just as skeptics characterize search for authenticity as Protestant Buddhism, it seems appropriate to describe this form of skepticism as denialist Buddhism. The unifying characteristic of the various forms of denialism is their insistence on extreme, unreasonable skepticism regarding any truth claims they oppose. The following quote is from a tobacco industry executive, but it might just as well describe the fundamental principle of the skeptics of early Buddhism. So that's a bit of a low blow there, but anyway, I think it's justified. We are committed to an ill-defined middle ground which is articulated by variations on the theme that the case is not proved. Okay? I mean, that's almost, you know, if you read the works of people like Gregory Chopin and so on, when they're talking about early Buddhism, that might be absolutely a, you know, a quote from him or a characterization of his work. Denialist movements share a common intellectual ancestry in that they appropriate elements of postmodern thought in order to marginalise or denigrate science, and they share an unmistakable tell by which they can be distinguished from genuine scepticism. And this is a very important point, you know, because it's not that there's anything wrong with scepticism. Scepticism's good, right? But denialists purport to be about a certain field, but they make no contributions to that field. This is the most important thing. Creationism has made no contribution to biology. I refuse to call it, what do they call it? Intelligent design. I refuse to use that word. Climate change denial has made no contribution to climate science, and denialist Buddhism has made no contribution to understanding the Buddha or his teachings. Its effect has been to dissuade people from even trying. There are genuine epistemological problems in the study of early Buddhism, in that we can all agree, but to argue as the denialists do, from epistemological uncertainty to dismiss the entire field, is to get everything backwards. To study early Buddhism is to study the origins of one of the great spiritual movements of humanity. It's a topic of intrinsic interest and worth. Of course, there are difficulties, as there are in any field, but genuine inquirers take the problems as a challenge and figure out ways to solve the problems. That's how science works. You make the unknown knowable. You don't run away from the problem and dismiss those who are trying to learn. And to me, this is the absolute characteristic of nihilism. It's about actually not learning, not knowing. And it's completely unscientific. So here's a quote from Gregory Chopin. It's, however, very likely that the canonical text will not tell us very much, and this perhaps gives rise to the broadest generalization that we can make. With this as a starting point, there's little wonder that this movement has produced little to help us understand the early Buddhist texts. The main product of this form of skepticism is doubt, and the main outcome of such doubt is to give up trying to learn. Here are a few characteristics of denialist theories which we are comparing with ideas found specifically in the writings of Gregory Chopin. The identification of perceived conspiracies, including belief in corrupted peer review and inversionism. Chopin attributes the absence of rules regarding stupas in the Pali Vinaya to their systematic removal by the Theravada monks. I'm not even going to bother kind of discussing that. The use of fake experts, often with the smearing of real experts. Climate change denialists often cite scientists who disagree with the consensus on global warming. On examination, the scientists almost invariably turn out to be experts in fields other than climate change. Similarly, and also, of course, almost invariably turn out to be in the pockets of the oil companies. Similarly, most of the hard skeptics come from a background of later Buddhism or Tibetan studies, while those who specialize in early Buddhism or Indian studies generally tend to affirm authenticity. This, again, was one of the things that actually got me started on this project. I look at the Wikipedia page that discusses this, and it gave a list of scholars who say that the texts are authentic and a list of scholars who say they're inauthentic. And it looks like it's kind of a nice balanced argument, right? There's a list of scholars and they're saying one, but actually, I know who these scholars are, right? And all of the scholars who are saying they're authentic were all absolutely the experts and authorities in the field. And all the ones who are saying they're inauthentic, I'm looking at them thinking, hang, who's that? And I looked it up and, oh, this is some specialist in tantric Buddhism from some university, and this is someone else. Oh, he's also an expert in tantric Buddhism and stuff. And well, actually, anyway, so I changed the Wikipedia page to reflect that. So that's a good thing about Wikipedia. Okay, so the supposed Protestant bias of early Indologists is criticized, but the denialists do not acknowledge their own biases as secularists, materialists, postmodernists, or academics. Everyone has biases. Appreciating a person's perspective helps understand their approach to a subject, but this needs to be done without dismissing reasonable arguments and conclusions. Another characteristic of denialism, demanding impossible standards for research. Okay, so you see, of course, how this always happens in climate change. You kind of leap on, you know, if you talk about probabilities and so on and so forth, they will always leap on this. So the critics point to the absence of early manuscripts or the absence of specific details in the archaeological record, such as early evidence of monasteries. This parallels the practice in climate change denialism or creationism of claiming to refute the science by pointing to the absence of certain concrete pieces of evidence. However, these theories do not depend on specific singular proofs, but on the convergence of large amounts of supporting data for which there is no better explanation. Inference, when properly used, does not rely on a chain of uncertain claims, one after the other, diminishing in probability when compounded, but on the convergence of multiple lines of reasoning and evidence that independently confirm the result. Okay? So the use of fallacy, including misrepresentation and false analogy. Chopin rarely considers seriously the methods used by scholars of early Buddhism, and when he does, he misrepresents them. For example, he says that the cardinal tenet of the higher criticism is that if all versions of a text agree, they must stem from a pre-sectarian tradition. This ignores the fact, which is a very basic one, that the main picture of Buddhist history in India was developed in the 19th century before any substantial comparative work was done. Scholars used a variety of methods, some of which we've outlined here, to arrive at conclusions that have, by and large, been confirmed by later comparative studies. So these are kind of the reasons for thinking of these attacks as being a product of this kind of intellectual mood of denialism rather than being something which is drawn from the understanding of the field itself. And so this is, to me, one of the conclusions, and I'll just finish with this. We live in an era of unprecedented potential for the study of early Buddhism. Internationally, more people than ever are interested in Buddhism. Emerging technologies have opened up entirely new ways of making texts available, analysing them. Much of the potential of the field remains virtually untouched. Most of the EBTs remain untranslated into English. The Pali translation, the Pali canon has been translated, but most of the other texts have not been. There has been little or no application of digital or statistical analysis to the text, which surely must be a field that offers promising insights. When so much basic work is left undone, it is absurd to claim that we cannot know anything. We simply don't know what we can know. Early Buddhism is a field of study in its infancy with a huge scope of texts and other evidence and a tiny population of serious scholars. We need to be supporting innovation and opening up frontiers, not prematurely dismissing the very possibility of knowledge. So I might just leave it there. We're at 4:30 already. Any final questions or comments or anything? Of course. No, not really. Yeah, I mean, there's a few bits that address that implicitly, but no, we're mainly. Yeah, we're mainly interested to get people to sort of take this sort of seriously and take an interest in them. And you know, of course, there are lots of different interpretations. That's part of the fun of it. But to me, the important things, I mean, you can focus on the fact there are different interpretations, but that's to ignore the fact that there are very many things about which, you know, scholars of early Buddhism, you'd absolutely take it for granted, right? I mean, just take one thing, being, say, the role of ritual in Buddhist practice, okay? Obviously, almost the entirety of Buddhist practice in much of contemporary Buddhism, and yet not mentioned in the early Buddhist texts at all. Okay? And so that's not something about which there's a divergency of opinion. You might have difference of opinion about what that means, but not about the fact of it. Yeah. Eddie? Well, thank you for sharing your experience, Eddie. Okay, that's all right. Any questions about the book before we finish up? Yeah. Sorry? Oh, what's the motivation for the denialists? Yeah, it's a good question. Okay, yeah, you make money. Well, so what are the motivations? It's a good question, and I think that it's something that needs to be looked at more closely. I'm not kind of in the academic community, so I'm not sort of aware of these things too much, but there are a number of things I'll just mention now. One of them is sort of shifting moods in academia. And the early Buddhism, the what we call modernist Buddhism, which was established by Thomas Rhys Davids and other scholars in the late 19th, early 20th century, okay, was based on a modernist and a positivist philosophy. That is the idea that we can use our reason to arrive at something approximating the truth. Okay? And that modernist idea was largely displaced in academic circles from the 70s and the 80s by postmodernism, which introduced this kind of mood of radical skepticism about the possibility of arriving at truth. And, for example, in postmodernism, you don't have any more kind of one overarching narrative, right? So there's no Buddhism. So there's countless articles in modern Buddhist studies. It's all about Buddhisms, right? So it's all about acknowledging the diversity thing, right? So obviously there's something true about that, right? It's not that that's wrong. We see Buddhism is diverse, and it's quite right to acknowledge that. And there's obviously can be a reductive sense if you try to explain the whole story in terms of one overarching narrative. There's obviously going to be a lot of other stories that you're going to be missing out on. So there's obviously some truth to that postmodernist critique, right? Again, it can be taken to an extreme. So this is one of the things with a shifting mood in academic circles, a mood which, incidentally, I think has now shifted again, and postmodernism itself is going out of style, although I'm not sure what's kind of replacing it. But anyway, so this is one thing. Another thing is a personal thing. When I've mentioned a few times the scholar Gregory Chopin, he was a student of De Jong, who was the great Sanskritist at the time. Okay, so we're now talking about the 50s, 60s, 70s. And De Jong was teaching, he was a professor of Sanskrit at the ANU, as it happens, in Canberra. And he was probably the world's greatest Sanskritist for much of that time. And Chopin and others went to study with him. And Chopin was a bit like kind of he was both a kind of brilliant student, but also a bit of an iconoclast. De Jong was a classic kind of absent-minded professor type, right? He was highly eccentric. He would often kind of refuse to talk to his students. Except by writing. He would kind of start the day with a massive pile of Sanskrit texts on his desk, and by the end of the day they'd be moved into the red pile. They had a conference on Sanskrit studies in Sydney around the time, and De Jong didn't want to go because he didn't kind of do conferences and things, but they insisted, and he just kind of sat on the stage as the kind of the elder professor. But he only communicated in writing, right? So obviously, you know, it's a classic absent-minded professor thing, right? And he was very, very text-based, almost perhaps excessively so. After De Jong died, Chopin's first work was to edit his papers, right? So he spent a few years putting together and editing De Jong's collected works and so on, and he then wrote a series of papers criticizing De Jong's methods and his whole approach, right? So part of this, I think, is based in that relationship. And Chopin has always been arguing that the Buddhism is more than just texts, it's more than just philosophy, it's actually a living community, and there are people who are flawed, and the ideal we have of a Buddhist monk, right, is not the reality of what actually Buddhist monks have done. And Chopin points out, for example, you know, we have this idea that Buddhist monks don't use money, right, whereas the reality is that most of the coins from ancient India have been recovered from Buddhist monasteries. Okay? So he wants to sort of juxtapose these two kinds of things. And again, there's something to that, right? And it's, you know, there's definitely a you know, something good in what Chopin's doing, right? And particularly Chopin's work about the middle period of Buddhism, I think, is very valuable. I just think his work on early Buddhism is where he went astray. So this, I think, was the second point, was this kind of personal connection. It also relates to cultural differences. Early Buddhist studies have always been prominent in England and Europe, and they've never been prominent in America. American Buddhist studies have always been based on Tibetan, Zen, and to some degree Chinese studies. And that's for various historical and cultural reasons. So as American Buddhism has become much more strong in recent decades, you know, Buddhism has become very popular there, so that the influence of those ideas among American Buddhism, I think, has filtered through to the academic sphere. So I think this is another thing. Another problem, I think, and this is a very serious one, is simply that early Buddhist studies is hard. And when I first discussed this with my friend Rob Bucknell many years ago, and we talked about this, and he sort of mentioned it, and he said, you know, not many people actually study Pali and stuff like that in the universities anymore. And this is kind of very true. And I said, well, what do they do? He said, well, I don't know, you go down to the local Korean Zen center and ask people what they practice, and then you do a survey and you write that. And that's your academic paper. I thought he was kind of joking, and then I went to some academic conferences, and that's exactly what they were doing. All right, and there was paper after paper of people, and that's exactly what they would do. Go to a Vipassana retreat, give people a form to fill out, get a survey, and then write a paper saying this is what people on Vipassana retreats do, and then that's your academic study. So if you compare that to the years or decades that it takes to study Pali and Sanskrit and Tibetan and Chinese, I mean, if you want to do serious studies, you have to do those four languages to begin with, then... I was recently in Germany and was speaking with a professor in Hamburg University, and you know, he's saying that they have a shockingly low enrollment rate for doing classical Indological studies. You know, only maybe one or two students per year who come through who are actually prepared to do the work to do all those languages and so on. So that's, I think, is another problem. I think that these things are not insoluble, you know. I mean, if it's difficult to learn Pali and things like that, okay, well, you develop tools and methods that's going to make it easier to learn Pali, rather than just sort of opting out and taking the easy path. But yeah. So hopefully that's given a few reasons why. Yeah, motivation. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes.
Observe the Vinaya and meditate, you know, walk and sing, walk and sing, and we'll see the light of the day. These are the scholarly monks.
Sure. Yeah.
Well,
I don't know. I mean, to my honest, I think it's another kind of laziness. I've seen a lot of monks make these kind of arguments and practitioners and things like that. And at the end of the day, honestly, I think it's, a lot of it's just coming from laziness. And I think that if you hear, and this is a point that was made by Bhante Dhammabuddha, who pointed out many years ago that if a meditation teacher is telling you, you know, you don't need to read the suttas, just follow the meditation instructions, then he's telling you, don't listen to the Buddha, listen to me. Yeah? And I think that's wrong. And I think then, I don't think there's anybody in the world, or very few people in the world, have so much wisdom that they can't benefit from listening, hearing something that the Buddha said. Yeah.
I can see that historically, many monks or nuns in the olden days spent a lot of the time memorizing the suttas.
Sure.
That must take huge effort.
It does take a lot of effort, yeah, but it's one of those things which is a lot easier if you're doing some meditation, yeah? And this is, you know, something I was talking to, when I was in Germany November, and I stayed with Venerable Analia for a couple of days, and we kind of talked about this, and those of you who have been trying to keep up with Venerable Analia's output would know that he produces a massive quantity of incredibly well-researched articles and these kinds of things. And he said he was talking about this with one of the professors, who said, you know, I've got no idea how you can manage to write so many articles. And he said, meditation. Yeah, that's how he writes them. And he basically does like... 3 or 4 days a week he'll just meditate, and 3 or 4 days a week he'll spend doing his articles. And, you know, when he's come out of his meditation, his mind's very clear, he knows exactly what he wants to do, and he just sits down there and does it. And you realize actually how much time we waste by doubting and being uncertain and all of these kinds of things. Yeah? And so if you have that clarity of mind through meditation, you can actually do that. So yes, of course, does memorizing scriptures take a lot of time and effort and so on? Of course it does, right? But you've got to remember that it's part of a lifetime, right? I mean, you're ordaining as a monk for the whole of your life, yeah? So you can recite scriptures for 4 hours a day, right? And you've still got many hours a day to meditate and do other things. So it doesn't mean that they weren't doing that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's certainly something to that. You find that within the Sri Lankan tradition, that's mentioned explicitly, that when the texts were written down, that there was a decision made that the practice of the text wasn't so important, and that preserving them was more important. Yeah, and that's mentioned in the tradition, in the histories. So obviously the community, there's been a mix within any community. I'd love to see much more meditators and things like that. But what I'd mainly like to see would be less of a division between the kind of the meditation and the scholarly side. And I've never seen these things as being in conflict. Yeah. You know, in the forest tradition, there's always this kind of forest tradition has this reputation for being opposed to studying and stuff like that. I remember we went to see one forest monk once in northeast Thailand, and he's one of the kind of old, kind of hardcore old school Ajahns, and we asked him his question, about studying and things like that, and he said, well, you just have to look at the effect on your meditation. If it's actually helping you to understand Dhamma and helping your meditation, then that's good, do the study. If it's not, then leave it to one side.
Showing my ignorance here, the Buddha had two sort of main followers, Ananda and another one, and one was more sort of the scholarly intellectual type and the other was more the heart sort of type, is that?
You're probably thinking of Sariputta and Moggallana, who were the two kind of main followers, and Sariputta was the wisdom master and Moggallana was the psychic powers master. Yeah. But Ananda, of course, was also very prominent in being the founder of the textual tradition. But it's a fair enough point, that within the early Buddhist texts, it's actually one of the nice things that you see is that there's an acknowledgement of diversity within the Sangha and an appreciation of that. And so the Buddha will always praise those good qualities. If someone's studying the Dhamma, he'll praise that and support that. If they're doing the meditation, he'll praise that and support that. So rather than saying everybody has to be doing the one thing. Again, this is something I would see is a characteristic of a kind of a lessening that you often see in contemporary Buddhism. And people will take one thing that they think is like so important and you have to do that. And it's not that the thing they're talking about is wrong. It's just, well, actually there are many different ways of practicing Dhamma. And so you don't find that within the suttas. You find this great breadth. Yes. Ah, yes. Maybe it comes down to funding, yeah. Not necessarily, what we call it anti-Buddhism, but whether funding is another issue, I'm not sure. It may well be the case. I mean, it certainly is the case. For example, Gregory Chopin's books have been very popular, and I'm sure his courses are very popular. Again, my friend Rob Buckner, when he was teaching at the University of Queensland, I mean, his love was early Buddhist texts, and, he was great expert in it, and he would teach Buddhist textual Chinese, right? This is the language of the early Buddhist texts. And he spent like 20, 30 years of his life learning and studying this and teaching it. And he would often have not enough, he had to have four students to actually constitute a course. And he would often not have four students. And so he would actually teach the course for free. And meanwhile, he would teach business Chinese and get like 40, 50 people along for that, So that's where he'd actually make his living. So there may well be something to that. I think if you're aiming to teach these kind of more hardcore, Indological, language-based courses, which are kind of prerequisite to serious study, then you're unlikely to get many students and unlikely to get much support from the university, whereas you teach something which is a bit more kind of sociologically based, a bit more philosophically based, and so on, then I think you're likely to get more popular courses, yeah. Yes?
You allude to it in the book about the sort of affordances of the digital age. That's where the internet becomes so important, because you can you know, an expert.